the most trusted and longest-running sports talk show in Tennessee. From the Budweiser studios of Cumulus Broadcasting, this is Sports Talk with John Wilkerson and Jimmy Hines on Sports Radio WNML.
We welcome you to Sports Talk on this Thursday afternoon. I'm John Wilkerson with Jimmy Hyams, and we are loaded with a program and a half today. Still, we're going to squeeze it into 4 hours. We're with you until 7 o'clock, but a little bit later this hour, we will catch up with our good friend David Ligon, who not only is a VFL, but also a Sports Radio WNML alum. That'll be a little bit later this hour. Chris Lowe of ESPN joins us to start hour number two. We'll talk baseball with former Smokies GM Brian Cox. That'll be at 4:35. Brent Hubbs of AllQuest.com will be along for hour number three of the program, his normal time slot with us, and we look forward to another challenging trivia question with the Sports Fix at 6, and we look forward to catching up with former Cy Young Award winner and VFL R.A. Dickey. That's around 6:15. So we have all that and more, a full lineup today on Sports Talk. Jimmy Hyams, how are you?
I'm doing great, John. We're loaded. We got a lot coming your way, so hopefully folks will enjoy it. But a lot of news and notes, and we'll jump to it. News and notes brought to you by Image Matters, technology that you need, people that you can trust. So, it's Jeremy Pruitt's 46th birthday. How did folks celebrate today? I know that it was kind of funny. I'd had a conversation with somebody earlier. I said, man, Tennessee hadn't had a commitment in the last 48 hours. What are they doing over there? But, no, they've had a great run at it. And if I were to point to somebody that I think might be the closest to making a decision of those players Tennessee's recruiting, I'd say it's a tight end, Hudson Wolf, out of Savannah, Tennessee. I think he's a guy that Tennessee feels like they're in good shape with him. So watch for that one. I think there's a pretty good chance that he might do something relatively soon. You never know. All right, a few other notes out there. As far as the SEC Women's Basketball Big 12 Challenge, Tennessee is going to be taking on West Virginia. Tennessee has a 6-0 lead in games against West Virginia. And Tennessee has one player who is from West Virginia, Emily Saunders. Now, they have not set the dates on when this game is going to be played, but the Lady Vols taking on West Virginia in the SEC Big 12 Women's Basketball Challenge. Look forward to that. Also, there are two from the University of Tennessee that have won the Brad Davis Community Service Award. They give that award to a male and female at each school, and then there is an overall winner. The overall winner gets a $10,000 postgraduate scholarship. The winners, the undergraduates at this point, get a postgraduate of $5,000 if they have won from a school. They get $10,000 if they win it overall. And those from Tennessee, Elisa Adrino in volleyball, and then Nathan Murray in swimming and diving. So those are the Tennessee winners, and congratulations to them for that. All right. Also with Marty McDaniel, we talked about him being on the Tennessee Lady Vols staff as a pitching coach for 16 years. We did hear that he's going to get paid through October the 31st. So even though he resigned, he's going to get paid through October the 31st. All right, a few other notes out there. The NCAA extending its dead period in recruiting to July the 31st. That's interesting. It makes you wonder how effective folks are going to be. Obviously, Tennessee's been incredibly effective with its recruiting during a dead period. Other schools maybe not, many other schools not as effective in doing this, but Tennessee certainly got the hang of it and did a great job, but they have extended that dead period to July the 31st. Hey, congratulations to Buck Jones. The Greater Knoxville Sports Hall of Fame has cited him for special recognition. For 50 years, he was the public address announcer for Tennessee track and field events. He also has been a Tennessee basketball scorer since 2004. He's been on the Knoxville Open Golf Committee for many, many years. He's also was very instrumental in the Tennessee Sports Management Program. He received a Tennessee Track and Field Lifetime Achievement Award, a Tennessee Honorary Letterman in 2005, and the Tennessee Governor's Award in 1992. So special recognition goes to a special guy. That is Buck Jones. Congratulations to him. The NASCAR race, the Cup race in Charlotte, postponed to today. The Bristol race, the Xfinity race, which is going to be Saturday, has now been moved to Monday. Kentucky's Johnny Juzang, who transferred to UCLA, has already gotten a waiver to be eligible at UCLA. So that led me to make a phone call. If that's the case, has Tennessee heard anything about Cade Mays, the transfer from Georgia, as an offensive lineman? I was told no. So Tennessee doesn't have word yet on Cade Mays' appeal to become eligible right away. I saw where the commissioner of the AAC, Mike Oresko, said that the AAC is prepared to play even if some of the teams are not ready. That the one or two teams, if they're not ready to play, they don't want to hold the other teams back. We talked to Tom Hart of the SEC Network yesterday, and he feels that's exactly what the SEC would say. The AAC comprised nine states, and of course we know that many states have had a different impact with COVID-19, so some places may be ready to go, others not. The AAC will go forward if they only have a couple of teams that aren't able to play. Also, some sad news here. An incoming UAB football player, Jamari Smith, drowned. He was 18 years old. He drowned in a lake in Alabama. That's Lee County, which I think is Montgomery area. No foul play was suspected, but he died. And it's just so important right now. Obviously, a lot of people want to get out and swim, and it seems like Memorial Day week kicks off a big swimming season for a lot of people. But, folks, just be careful out there. I don't know anything about what happened to him, but it's just be careful. Basketball Hall of Fame induction ceremony has been moved to the spring. They said it's not feasible to try to do it before then. They were hoping for August. They were hoping for October. Unable to find a way to do that. So it has been moved. Here's something else that's going to be interesting, I think. So when Oklahoma and Texas play, it's the Red River rivalry. I've got to where I have to say that slow. They're going to be playing in the Cotton Bowl, allegedly. It's been mentioned that it's in conjunction with the Texas State Fair, and what better place to spread the virus than at a state fair? So there is some concern about whether or not they'll play the game, and if they do, will it be without fans? How are they going to monitor that? It'll be interesting to see how that one plays out. In Mexico, they will not play soccer in the United States until fans are able to return. Mexico usually plays five friendlies a year in the United States. The Premier League soccer team is resuming June the 17th. Good news. European golf tour is resuming July the 22nd. No fans will be allowed. They will play six consecutive weeks starting in the United Kingdom for those matches. So that's good news. Not so good news, MLB Players Association. It's going to be interesting to see how this one plays out. Max Scherzer came out and said that they will not even engage in further discussions. They have already agreed to a pay cut in their prorated pay. I have a different view on that than he does. Here's my view. I don't really think taking a prorated salary is a pay cut. I think a pay cut is when you take less money for playing in a game. If you play 100 games and you're paid your salary for what you would make in a game, whether it's $10,000 and that's what you make in a game and you get paid $10,000 for the 100 games you play, I don't see that as a pay cut. I wonder how they would look at it if they didn't play the whole year. Would that be a one-year pay cut? Or would it be you just didn't get paid because you didn't play? So I kind of see that one differently. I haven't decided where I'm going on this one. I think the owner's proposal looked to me to be out of line yesterday, although if that proposal ended up with a net of a 50-50 split, then I'm not as so much against it. If indeed, as the players are saying, they had an agreement for a prorated salary in March, then I think the owners are wrong. If the owner said it's prorated only if we have fans, then I'm switching back to okay. Basically, I would like to see a 50-50 split, however they get to that. I don't know if they can make it. I'll say this, too, and I've really gotten to where I dislike this guy. Well, let me just say this. I never agree with this guy named Dominic Foxworth. He's on ESPN. They have him for a whole lot of different things that he comments on, and I think the next thing he says I agree with might be the first. But he said this. He said if the owners can't take a big loss, if they can't deal with these tough times, then they have no business being an owner. Okay. Really? So you're saying that the owners should basically take the brunt of this, and if you don't have a whole lot of money, too bad on you. you should still pay the players. And in fact, he said he didn't even think the players should take a prorated salary. He thinks they should get paid everything. I 100% disagree with everything he said. So maybe that's just me, but I've heard him before, and I can't find anything where I agree with him. But he used to be the NFLPA president. Every viewpoint he has sides with players. He's always painting the owners as the bad guys, and sometimes the owners are the bad guys. But I can't fathom where you would think that the players should get paid 100% of the salary when you're going to play 100 games or maybe less. I am interested to see two things. One, the players' proposal that they submit, and it looks like it's going to be 100 games with a prorated salary. All right. The other thing I'm interested in, and I think Scherzer brings up a really good point, he said this. He said if Major League Baseball, if their economic strategy, he wondered if it would change if all the documents were made public. I'll agree with that. So what he's saying is the owners should show their hand. What are you getting with local TV money? What are you getting with national money? What are you getting with sponsorship? What are you getting projected financially? Is your projection financially that you're going to be making a lot of money and the players are getting less than the 50-50? I don't know. I do think the owners must be transparent in these negotiations to figure out exactly where they can get this thing to an amenable situation. I don't know if they can, but I agree with Scherzer on that. I think that the owners have to open the books and say, hey, this is where we are, and this is why we're proposing what we are proposing. John, how do you see this?
I couldn't agree more. I just think you spell it out very specifically, and I think right on target. And that is, in an instance like this, and I think there would be perhaps greater understanding from the players if indeed they were transparent and didn't give the impression that perhaps, oh, well, we're all in this together, as opposed to here's why we need you and would very much appreciate your doing this for this year and this year mm-hmm. alone. I think they need to showcase exactly what they're up against. And I just think that might be the first step into building a bridge over what looks to be really, really troubled water.
See, and here's the thing, too. I don't know the language of this, but if you say we're going to have a 50-50 split with revenues, okay, does that revenue include local TV revenue? Does it include the national TV revenue? Does it include sponsorship of what's on, billboards at your stadium for games? I don't know those things. So I think there has to be a definition of what the revenues are in a 50-50 split. That would be something else I would be interested in knowing. But, again, hopefully we get to an agreement on this. We'll see. This is kind of, I guess, philosophical, but I thought it was kind of interesting. We can touch on this for a little bit. So I watched the first of two segments on Lance Armstrong on the 30-30, and I used to be a big Lance Armstrong fan, not anymore. Was very upset with him lying all these years about not taking PEDs, also attacking those that said he was taking them. So it really bothered me. Maybe a little bit like people were bothered that Pete Rose lied for all those years. Well, Lance Armstrong lied for all these years too. But somebody later said something about Armstrong, and then they made this comment. There are good people who do bad things, and there are bad people who do good things. And they were talking about which one is Lance Armstrong. it was an interesting question to me. In watching the first segment of that documentary, I saw Lance Armstrong raising a whole lot of money for cancer, for charities. Those are good things that he did. The bad, lying all these years, taking the PEDs and crossing that line that he did. So I just thought it was an interesting take. Maybe after watching the second segment of this documentary, and I can't believe they're not 10. Doesn't everybody do 10 parts documentaries now? But I want to see the second one and then kind of make a determination on Armstrong. But right now, I'm not an Armstrong fan. Maybe there could be something Sunday night that could twist my feelings a little bit. But I'll be curious, John, about that. Did you watch the first segment with Armstrong?
Did not. planned to, because it was such an incredible story at the time, and then what a turn it took in terms of the narrative and what came to light long down the road afterwards. But I also agree a lot with how you painted the picture in the sense that he was somebody that everybody got behind in terms of great support and everything, and then boy, folks like in that boat had the rug pulled out from under him with everything that did come to light and all that he had done. And granted, for him to overcome what he overcame to still compete, that's beyond impressive. But just the way that he painted those that tried to assail his character as he portrayed it at the start was really ruthless at times. And so it's really an incredible story. And I can't think, I mean, when you look at where Tiger was and then, of course, created so much difficulty for himself, I think the fact that he was able to rebuild, come back, and win last year's Masters was an amazing reclamation story. Lance Armstrong just simply got to the top of the mountain and fell off. I think he might be the greatest riches to rags story that we've seen in perhaps modern athletic times.
Well, and I agree with that, and a part of that is that you had this feel-good story about he overcomes testicular cancer, he wins the Tour de France, he's this unbelievable cyclist, he's the best in the world for many, many years, and so much of it was under false pretenses and just outright lying. And so you talk about a fall from grace. So it's a very compelling story.
Yeah, and it's funny because with the free weekends that I've experienced this spring for the first time in forever, I've been going through a ton of stuff. I came across my old Live Strong bracelet, the yellow rubber band set situation. And one, remember how hard it was to find those because everybody was snapping them up, but still have my Live Strong. And I'll say this, as you point out, there are bad people that do good things, good people that do bad things, but there was so much hope that his fight and success story against cancer provided for others. That's right. Always going to be a halo for him. So even though there are big segments that are tainted in terms of his days as an athlete, what he did for those that were battling cancer, families that were battling cancer, in regards to giving them hope and a path to follow, to me, that'll always be his brightest shining moment, because that was amazing. Just the communal feel there was to not just him, but everybody that had a battle in some way, shape, or form. And of course, we all know that cancer sucks, and it does. It continues to do so to this day. And we wish everybody that opportunity to just fight the best fight they can possibly put together.
And when we come back, we will talk about a projection of where former Tennessee baseball pitcher Garrett Crochet might be going in the Major League Baseball draft. Those are news and notes brought to you by Image Matters.
That's Jimmy Hyams. I'm John Wilkerson. 656-9900 is how you join us. 656-9900 puts you on Sports Talk on 99.1 The Sports Animal.
99.1 The Sports Animal. Just because your workday is boring doesn't mean your radio station has to be.
Sports Talk rolls on. I'm John Wilkerson with Jimmy Hyams.
And John, Garrett Crochet, a very talented pitcher for Tennessee. Just a shame that he wasn't able to pitch this year because they ended the season early due to COVID-19. But there is a projection that he could go mid-first round of the Major League Baseball draft.
Yes, you take a look at what is within reach, and I don't think there's any question that it really would have been something. It's such a shame Tennessee only got to see him work once for the Orange and White this past year with how short the season was and the fact that they were very mindful of what was some shoulder stiffness at the start of the season. Mm-hmm. But he has just an unbelievable amount of talent. In fact, I don't know if you happen to see the video that's circulating on Twitter, but he hit triple digits as he was working in a bullpen, throwing a bullpen session earlier, I think, this week. But you look at somebody who's just got sheer power, left-handed, and he projects to go with the 14th pick in the draft. As you mentioned, this according to Jim Callis on MLB.com. The 14th pick right now belongs to the Texas Rangers. There are only 29 picks in this year's first round. There's one team that doesn't get to pick. We won't talk about that. But they think the Rangers would perhaps have their eyes on a couple of others that if they fell to 14 might go. But as Callis wrote, I think they would be very happy to perhaps, quote-unquote, settle for Crochet if that's who they take at 14. But I think that he's going to go, and I also think in the five rounds of the draft, watch out for Alaric Solari as well.
Oh, yeah, there you go. I know that there are more pitchers now throwing at 100 miles per hour in the majors than ever. Are the majority of those right-handers, or do you know?
I believe they are, because I think the majority of pitchers are right-handed. So I just think that you have more, you know, we've always heard about the crafty lefty. And yes. And I think the fact that you are a left-handed pitcher and can make the ball move, that probably gives you an opportunity that maybe somebody who has the exact same stuff that's right-handed may not get, simply for the fact that it impacts more of an opposing team's lineup more often than not. So, but the power lefty is somebody who can be such an addition and such a centerpiece to your rotation. I just think he's got that kind of stuff. And it's something that Tony Vitello has spoken in regards with to Garrett Crochet since he arrived on campus. You saw the raw talent when he was a freshman, and he was a late signee, which was amazing that he was still available. And so he was... You know, you got a taste of it as a freshman, and you just saw him increase his value with what he meant to the team, even bouncing back as quickly as he did from taking that line drive to the jaw to help Tennessee in the postseason in their return to the NCAA tournament. And again, I don't think anybody could wait to see him. It really would have been something to see if indeed when Tennessee and Vanderbilt would have played, and I think that would have been series number two of the SEC schedule for the Vols, it might have been Crochet and Rocker, and I think you would have had just the scout section alone might have been standing room only.
Yeah, boy, that would have been some good stuff to see that. But wish the best for Garrett Crochet and also Alaric Solari as the draft is. John, is it June 13? When is the...
I think it's the 10th. I'll double-check on that. But I think it is the 10th, the first round. But, I think all five rounds are going on the same day. I'll double-check on that. But we'll get a break. When we return, we get to catch up with a longtime friend of the program and a good friend in David Ligon. He joins us next on 99.1 The Sports Animal. Sports Talk continues with Jimmy Hyams. I'm John Wilkerson, and as we are fortunate to share one Saturday to the next, we have Vol Network Classics, and this week it is the 2006 win for Tennessee against Georgia. You heard Eric Ainge catch up with his center, Josh McNeil, on today's program to talk about that, and we certainly wanted to share in the memories as we have our good friend, Vol for Life David Ligon, not only a Saturday Sports Talk alum, but also high school football alum with Sports Radio WNML, and he joins us now on the Stanley Fencing and Gates Hotline. David, always great to catch up with you. How are you?
I'm doing great, John. I hope you and Jimmy are doing well, too.
Yes, sir. Big thumbs up. And, of course, you've got such a growing family. I'm just wondering, everybody safe and sound through all this, whether it be East Tennessee, West Tennessee, even Rob Damastis?
Yes. Yeah, no, I think everybody's doing really well, considering, and hope everyone out there listening is, making it through and, looking forward to getting life back on track soon.
Well, glad to hear that, and certainly echo your sentiment. And for those that don't know, Rob is David's brother-in-law. But when we talk about the game,
I try to keep that on the down low.
and I think we all know why.
Right.
When it comes to that Tennessee-Georgia game, you go back to the 2006 season What was going through your mind? Where did Georgia rank, first of all, when it came to those teams that you looked forward to? You kind of circled on the schedule. Where did the Bulldogs rank in terms of those you couldn't wait to square off against?
Oh, wow. Yeah, they were right up there at the top with the Floridas and the Alabamas. Really, obviously Florida and Georgia being East rivals that you had to get through if you wanted to go to Atlanta. But particularly just on the team in general, we had a lot of guys from the state of Georgia. And boy, they were so pumped up every year to play them. And it was a, back then, Georgia was, I guess really you'd say was the team to beat, up until really that 2006 season. They had won, the SEC championship, in 2002 and 2005. Mark Richt really, was at the pinnacle of his run there.
David, that was a game that Georgia jumped out to a 24-7 lead. Can you recall the mindset of the Tennessee team at that point?
Oh, absolutely. I remember exactly where I was when they went up 24-7. They had, I guess it was 17-7, and they had gotten the ball back, and it was like under – it was just a couple minutes to go in the half. And I remember, Tereshinsky had this real big – I think it was a pass play to the fullback of all people. And I can remember thinking, are you kidding me? The fullback just made this big play in our defense. And then I may have been just a couple plays later. I think it was that same fullback scores. And, they go up 24-7. And I can remember sitting on the bench thinking, are you kidding me? And it really, what it reminded me of a little bit was the 2003 game. If you remember, we had, kind of a bad handoff there, getting ready to score right before the half, and they returned it for a touchdown, and then Georgia runs away the game. And I remember sitting here thinking, is that about to happen? Are they getting ready to just run away? All this hard work we've put in, I think we're 4-1 at that point. We're still in the hunt for the East, even though we had lost to Florida. It was the SEC, anything could happen. And I just was kind of dumbfounded. I was like, this really stinks. But we hadn't – it's not that we had had – they had been really beating us bad on offense. I mean, we were doing okay, just when we weren't finishing. And then we ended up going out there. We just kind of kept at it. I mean, there wasn't this overwhelming sense of dread. It's like, man, we really got to just get to work. We've got to just keep doing the little things right, and we're going to score. And then we did. We ended up scoring, I think, with like a minute or a little bit less than a minute to go in the half to make it 24-14 going into the half.
Well, I had misremembered this. I thought in my mind, boy, that block punt for a touchdown Antonio Wardlow scored, that put Tennessee ahead. That's not true. It extended the lead to 38-27. So Tennessee had already rallied to take the lead. And the other part of this equation I forgot, after that touchdown, Georgia ran the kickoff back for a touchdown. So there wasn't a whole lot of time to rest to think, hey, we got this one. And that occurred the fourth quarter, both of those plays.
Yeah, I think we ended up putting quite a few points on the board in the fourth quarter. But, the thing about that game that really stick. Yeah, I mean, and you know what? It was a team effort, because at halftime, I never heard a chewing like this. The defense tore into so bad. And boy, oh boy, did they respond. And it wasn't, they went back out and they started, making stops, getting turnovers. Special teams stepped up big time, obviously with the Wardlow block punt for a touchdown. But when you go back and you start looking at some of the kickoff returns, some of the punt returns, I mean, the return game was there. Things just started falling into place. And, I mean, obviously it ended up, we walked out of there with a 51-point win or, score to win the game. And it just that game to me, there's so many awesome memories from that night. It was a cool, crisp autumn night. You felt great, but it was like it was the quintessential Maxim game of if the gamer breaks, go against you, don't let up, put on more steam, and that's just kind of what we did. We just kept at it, kept going. The offense wasn't big and flashy. We had some decent pass plays in there. There was a lot of underneath stuff, and we just kept grinding and scoring points. The defense was making plays, and that's what contributed to such a big win.
Do you remember being in a game before where you were down, Tennessee or in high school, where you were down like that, and then you just had this avalanche of momentum that carried you to such a win, which in this case was 51-33?
I would probably say the LSU game from the year before down in Baton Rouge. You know, we were, I mean, it was kind of a late rally there. I mean, it was another huge fourth quarter there performance to go into overtime and ultimately win the game. But it was, you know, a little bit like this. This though, just kind of had that slow building crescendo that just like, you know, it just, things kept going right and we kept making the right plays. Whether it's that game was kind of more of just like a big spark there, I think late in the fourth quarter, but similar.
It really, of course, used to be a big, big deal. Still an okay deal, but the victory put Tennessee on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And, you know, back when newsstands and magazines used to be a much bigger thing, I'm just wondering, what was it like to see that performance result in what was a national spotlight?
Oh, that was one of the neatest things. I mean, I still have that copy of that Sports Illustrated. I think that cover is forever linked to that game. And I mean, we at that point in time, you go to 5-1, you're in the hunt. I mean, we're ranked. I mean, we're that game against Georgia. I think they were 10, and we were maybe 13. It was two top 15 teams. I mean, we're moving up the rankings, and we were kind of back. And I think there's a picture inside in the story about us. Of one of the touchdowns, you know, I'm in there, and I always thought that was kind of neat. Like, man, I'm in Sports Illustrated. How cool is that? You know, I don't know if that's the same kind of neat thing for kids today, but it was for me, and I still have a copy of it. And you know, I hope I always do. It's I probably need to get the thing framed.
You guys had lost to Florida, and so you were 4-1 going into that game. Yep. Georgia had not lost, and it was after that game. I mean, you guys started what was 4 losses in 5 games for the Bulldogs, and I know you just hate to see that, right?
Yeah, I know that's such a shame. But you know, I mean, for them, they're the defending SEC champion. I mean, that was a huge deal, and then for them to kind of, I guess that. You know, Georgia's always been a strong football team and a tough one to overcome. But, you know, it helps us because we get a lot of good players out of Georgia. And when we're the better team, more of them seem to want to come to us.
David, one of the really outstanding performances for Tennessee that game, Arian Foster. He didn't have a lot of yards. He had 63, but he scored 3 touchdowns. Just talk about how good of a running back you think he was.
Yeah, I think Arian saw the field really well. He had really great endurance, so he could run at a high level, and he just never seemed to get tired. And you could see that in the summer and spring workouts. I mean, the guy was always there at the front, kind of a deceptive stride there with speed. That long stride didn't maybe look like he was going as fast as he was, but you know, I think that. You know, he was able to catch the football. He's a bigger body. You know, could be harder to bring down, but just that smooth glide and could see the field and make, hey, there, that's where I need to go and get those extra yards. And it may not be a lot, like you said, it wasn't a lot of yards, but they were crucial. And he knew where to get it in there. And, you know, if you go back and I think some of the things he got knocked for with fumbles is, well, in this game, he sticks the ball out and he gets in there right before the half, giving us, you know, 7 points. You know, nobody talks about that. So, you know, but you live and die with that.
Also, Eric Ainge, he had a really good freshman year, not so good at his sophomore year, but his junior year with David Cutcliffe, he came back and played extremely well. Just talk about the turnaround for Eric Ainge.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was obvious. You obviously, you guys all saw the way he played on the field, and he was a very different football player. He still was a very gifted quarterback. I mean, you know, you go back and you look at his freshman year and some of the throws he makes without set feet. I mean, the guy has an arm, he had a cannon. And Coach Cutcliffe just took that and broke him back down. I mean, you can see the change in how he dressed. And that's attributed to Coach Cutcliffe. And I think you could see him develop as a person, becoming a leader. Enjoyed becoming a student of the game, being led by Coach Cutcliffe because he's such a sharp, sharp football mind and makes it so interesting. And I just always loved hearing him talk about football. And I think Eric really, really dug that and bought in. That was the key. He said, I'm going to be coachable because I want to be a good player. And Coach Cutcliffe, you know, took that that talent that he had and you know, molded him into a great player just like he's done with so many other quarterbacks.
You've already mentioned a couple of times, David, what it was like to get more than 50 points on the board in that game. You and Jimmy, of course, talked about it, just the incredible turn, you know, tale of two games, down big and then come back to win big. The thing I remember most and what I enjoyed so much about dealing with, working with David Cutcliffe, you could just tell when he was pleased. And I'll never forget, if I had had a $5 bill for every time he mentioned in the media availability after the win in Athens, we hung half a hundred on the Bulldogs, I would have had at least $25. But I'm just wondering, what was it like to play for Coach Cut and to see those instances where game plans paid off to the point you could just tell he was genuinely pleased with how everything played out?
Oh, it I mean, that to me as well, saying, hey, we scored 51 points in Sanford Stadium against a good Georgia football team. At that time, I think it was the most points ever scored against them in that stadium. I think it's since been broken, unfortunately, but I'd like to still hold the record. But one of the special memories I hold, just in general, my playing career as well, as it came from this game. It was after the game, in the tunnel, you know, in shower, getting ready to get on the bus. You know, one of the things I always saw growing up watching SEC football, you know, when there's a big upset at Sanford Stadium, the other team would go rip chunks out of the hedges. You know, you're playing between the famous hedges. I'm going to get a piece of it. And I got an opportunity to do that in 2004, and got an opportunity to do it my senior year in 2006. I remember getting a huge chunk, and I shared some of that with my left tackle, Aaron Sears, and I shared the other piece of that with Coach Cutcliffe there in the tunnel, and I think he really appreciated it. It was kind of a neat little souvenir maybe that we shouldn't have done, but we did. And I always thought it was a tradition in college football, and I still have that piece. It's dried out. It looks great. The leaves are still on it, and either it's in my office somewhere at the house, or maybe at my parents' house. But it's with the ticket that they had from the game, and it's just a special memory that I will, you know, always hold on to. Getting a big hug from him, and you know, allowing him to maybe have that, go put in a shadow box somewhere in his house to remember that win.
David, who are some of your Tennessee teammates that you keep tabs with to this day?
You know, you see guys around town. I mean, as we get older, you know, there's more and more guys. You know, I run into Eric on the occasion, and, you know, it's just, you never know. I mean, sometimes you'll see, you know, guys that, were your class or older. I mean, it's, oh gosh, just a little bit here and there across the board. I mean, some of my old offensive line, like it's been a couple of years since I've seen McNeil, but I think at one point he was around here, and, you know, I've seen Richie Gandy around town on the occasion. It's always good to see those guys and catch up. Obviously, we still have events. And, you know, one of the neat things about, you know, playing at a place like Tennessee that I've enjoyed is getting to know some of the guys that, you know, are older and younger than you too, particularly the ones that are older, because of the coaching continuity that we had has always been pretty special, because they even though they played – you know, 10, 15, you know, years or 5 years before you, a lot of those experiences are the same. You know, I mean, Coach Cutcliffe and Coach Chavis and Coach Fulmer, I mean, they didn't really change a lot of the things they did. So we can, even though we didn't experience it together, we can kind of commiserate of morning runs or things like that. So I've enjoyed that and that fraternity. And it doesn't matter if, you know, someone played 10 years after you or before you, you know, it's like you all played together, and that's been really special.
And, David, you, of course, would go on to be a part of Vol Network coverage. You did high school football with me. I was blessed with that for many years. And, of course, a big part of Saturday Sports Talk. How much did you enjoy that aspect of still staying connected and just giving your thoughts on Tennessee and college football?
I really enjoyed that. That was, you know, there was a few years there, John, where I had busy weekends. I mean, I may have worked more on the weekends than I did during the week. But you know, there was it I can't remember the year, maybe 2009, 10 or something. We had a game in Columbia, a playoff game with Catholic that was a late start. And I think by the time I got home, I just stayed up for another hour and then joined old Josh in the studio at 6 a.m. for Saturday Sports Talk. So I didn't go to bed that night, but it was fun. I miss it. Obviously my my time is very valuable now with the four little ones, and get pulled in a lot of directions with that. But, you know, I always do enjoy having the opportunity to do the occasional, you know, spot. I know, you know, Pennington's always, he's always calling me and like, when are you going to come back? I'm like, oh gosh, it's, I'd love to go do some shows with him and with you guys. It's just, unfortunately, you know, the little kids, they're kind of demanding.
Well, and of course, your wife Jamie is an LVFL, and so Lady Vol for life. And I just wonder, have you guys received any scholarship offers for the younger Lincoln Jet?
Oh no, not yet. We gotta get them, I guess, in organized sports at some point. We haven't done that yet, but there's some. I think there's some potential there. We've got a few that they've shown some athletic ability, so we'll see.
Hey, David, thank you so much for your time today. Hope everyone continues to be safe and sound, and can't wait to this fall when we get to pick games with you on a Friday.
Oh, sounds great. Look forward to it. Thanks, John and Jimmy.
Thanks, Dave.
All right. Thank you. David Ligon, Vol for Life, great guy. We appreciate him joining us on the Stanley Fencing and Gates Hotline. We'll get a break. A final segment to this hour of Sports Talk is next on 99.1 The Sports Animal.
Here at The Sports Animal, we never really grew up. We just learn how to act in public, most of the time.
We come back to say so long for this first hour of Sports Talk. I'm John Wilkerson with Jimmy Hyams, and we certainly appreciate David Ligon's time. We will say this, when we are on with somebody, we don't hear when there is a weather alert. So we don't necessarily apologize for it. We understand that it can be frustrating, especially if it's to highlight something that may not be in your neck of the woods that it's highlighting. But that goes along, Jimmy, with being in this position to try and get the word out as to National Weather Service and alerts, warnings, things like that. But if there was any part of the interview with David that you didn't hear but wanted to, you can look for it on our website, also on Twitter. You can just go through our station Twitter handle, and Sam and Ben do a great job getting everything together so folks can hear if they missed a guest while they had to take care of what they had to take care of.
Well, and David Ligon was outstanding, so you don't want to miss anything he said. But his recapping of that Tennessee-Georgia game back in 2006, really well done, and I think folks would love to hear that.
So you can find that at 99.1thesportsanimal.com as well as with Twitter. And we'll get a break. When we return, Chris Lowe of ESPN joins us to start hour number two of Sports Talk on 99.1 The Sports Animal.